Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lob Podcast with These Football Times. I'm Aidan Williams and we're heading back to Wales, to Cymru, for part two of our series on the Welsh national team and their tournament travails over the years. Part one has brought us through the triumphs of 1958 and 1976 and up to the end of the 70s via a bit of disappointment and controversy, and we can promise a bit more of that in the second part as we work our way through the 1980s and 90s. But before we get to all that, my two compadres on this adventure are with me again tonight, both of whom could certainly be entrusted with a late penalty with a World Cup place on the line. First, a man who only looks right in red, be that Liverpool or Wales, or Denmark as he's wearing today in his case, the Ian Rush of the episode, Stephen Scragg, of course. Not sure how you'd look with an 80s Rush moustache though, Stephen.
Oh, no, I'll have to try that one Movember, I suppose. I'm sure it would look suitably hideous. It'd come out ginger, I'd imagine, as well.
Oh, really? Oh, well, intriguing, yeah. Intriguing. And adding a bit of class and quality facial hair to the proceedings. And you could surely rely on to scissor kick a spectacular volley into the net in a vital qualifier. The Mark Hughes of the episode, therefore, Rhys Richards. How you doing, Rhys?
Oh, I'll take that. Yeah, definitely like to market myself as a Mark Hughes. I don't know if I've got the quads for it, but yeah. Great to be here, Aidan. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. Well, when we left things, Wales had failed to reach the 1978 World Cup in rather controversial style. That was followed up by missing out on the newly expanded Euros in 1980, but finishing only a handful of points behind eventual winners West Germany in a very tough group. But this brings us on to a couple of very near misses that, as with the 1976 story from the last episode, I think get a little bit lost in the mists of time or possibly bigger narratives, usually involving domestic disputes with Scotland. So Wales came into the 1982 World Cup qualifiers off the back of a hugely impressive 4-1 win over England in the 1980 British Home Championship. Now under the leadership of Mike England, ironically enough, and all the tales of Wales narrowly missing World Cups, this is actually probably the closest. Wales only missing out on goal difference. Rhys, it's a typical tale, I guess. We had similar stories with Scotland when we looked at them of performing well against the big teams, but slipping up against the weaker one.
Yeah, there's a bit of a pattern there, isn't it? I don't know if it's that kind of idea that you can motivate yourselves to play against the big boys. Maybe that's part of it as a smaller nation. Yeah, to kind of push yourself on, and then yeah, ultimately ending yet again in, I won't say disaster, but, you know, not success. We start off well, don't we, for the 82 qualifiers. Mm. So, out the blocks, with a head full of steam, win the first four, and then run out of steam after a really promising start. So, not to jump ahead too much, but it reminds me of my first qualifiers experience as a young man, as a fan in the modern era, just where, yeah, that kind of the optimism of the first couple of games dissipating and you know, making way for the crushing reality of what was to come later. It's interesting with that, for the 82 qualifiers. We were speaking in the last episode about the race course being this home of football that has a kind of mythical quality, and for this one, Wales seemed to tour quite a lot. So there was a game in Ninian Park. We played the race course, and then the Vetch and Swansea as well. So I wonder what the thinking was behind that. And I wonder if that did affect things.
That's interesting. Formula. Yeah, because the crucial one, the missed dropped point, I guess, that cost Wales in the end was a 2-2 home draw with Iceland at the Vetch field, mm-hmm. rather than either Ninian Park or the racecourse in Wrexham, which I guess have been more familiar for these qualifying or the crucial qualifying matches. I mean, I guess Iceland, maybe it's not viewed as the big ticket, the big one where it was all going to be on the line. But, you know, when things come to the crunch, every game is vital at these stages, isn't it? And every advantage you can get. Oh, my word.
It's pretty.
That's an extra tier to it there, if it had been in Wrexham.
It is. But, I mean, looking at the time, I can understand why they did it, because that's the Swansea City who were on a serious crest of a wave in 1982. You know, Gatecrest First Division, for 81-82. You know, they're actually kind of like in the title race in 81-82 for a long stretch of that season. So there is, you know, a shift in power base, you know, within Welsh football at that point in time. You know, Swansea is kind of the centre of the Welsh footballing universe, you know, away from individual players. So, but then again, you know, ironically, quite a lot of, well, it's a mix really, you know, because you know, John Toshatt does bring in quite a few of his old teammates and stuff like that. There's a, you know, he brings in Ray Kennedy and a lot of Liverpool players who had been in as part of that team beforehand. So I kind of get why the Vetch Fair. I remember those games, you know, and thinking, yeah, you know, and looking back, it kind of made sense where they did veer to the Vetch Field. But at the same time, yeah, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that they didn't quite get the points that they were looking for.
It's as though, yeah, they deliberately sent the toughest opponents to Wrexham, I think, don't they? You know, we'll come to things like Spain having to go there as well in due course, but Wales played the Soviet Union at Wrexham in this group and a 0-0 draw, which is a fantastic result against a powerful team.
Against that team, yeah.
Yeah, very much so. I think they've beaten the Czechs in Cardiff as well. So, yeah. I mean, it's some impressive results.
I'm sure the Iceland game was seen as something of a given. You know, they had gone to Reykjavik and won 4-0, you know, on the opening night, I think it was, of the qualifying campaign. Right. So, you know, to go to Iceland, win 4-0, I'm sure that thinking by the time they're coming to us, it wouldn't have mattered where they were playing. So, again, it's that slight oversight in a way. You know, maybe the Vetch Field would have been better for the British Home Championship games or something like that, you know, if they were wanting to spread them out. But, you know, make sure that you get those qualifying results over the line. And I think that's the great, I don't know, unlearned lesson that seems to flood through with Wales in this era. You know, be it Anfield 77 or, you know, not opting for the racecourse ground in a qualifier that we'll come up and chat about very soon.
Yeah, seems to be the thing. I mean, it's got to make it all harder to take, I guess, when qualification is denied by a supposed minnow. I mean, Iceland, they'd had a couple of other results in this group. I think they drew with the Czechoslovakia.
Oh, yeah,
Or at least ran them close. So they're no mugs. And they had players with Anderlecht and the likes of that in Europe, you know, the occasional good player, but not obviously not the depth.
Not the whipping boys that, you know, people would bill them as, basically. And there was this rise in Scandinavian football as well. And Norway, you know, ticked this box as well at this point in time because, you know, this is an era where they're beating England 2-1 and Lord Beaverbrook and everyone's getting to hear about it. And you know, Denmark, the rise of Denmark, you know, and none of them are taken seriously at this point in time, but they can all pull a result out of the hat when the wind blows in the right direction. They really fancy it. You know, the story of the likes of Iceland and the Denmark leading up to Danish Dynamite and Norway as well, and even Finland to a point. You know, because you can point to Finland holding England to goalless draw during the 86 qualifiers in Helsinki. You know, it was never a particularly easy place to go, but I think everyone, the expectation was that, you know, if you get them back onto home soil, then, you know, there's only going to be one result. And that was just something that Wales didn't get in this qualifier. And it was so pivotal. It was so pivotal. But to win those first four qualifiers for 82 and then only take 2 points from the next four, you know, that I don't think Wales ever put themselves into such a strong position to strike for qualifying as they did in this one. You know, they were often coming from behind or playing leapfrog. But in this one, I mean, to win your first four and then not qualify is pretty, I don't know, pretty devastating.
Well, as I say, I feel like that 82 qualifier and indeed the 84 tournament that we'll come on to now, they're a bit like the 76 quarterfinal, I guess, that they're a bit forgotten, overshadowed. I think it's the overall narrative of Wales, of the fact that it was against Scotland. Those others tend to overshadow it. I guess that's just the way of British media, I suppose. But I guess from the Welsh perspective, it must feel a bit galling to have such a close-run thing is often overshadowed by other World Cup disappointments. I guess we'll come on to some that would be maybe more iconic or more televised. Maybe that's the difference. But they came desperately close in 82 and again rather more painfully so, probably, in the 1984 European Championship. Now, I love this particular story. It's one I've looked into a fair bit. It's an incredible one. Wales twice coming within moments, and in some cases I literally do mean moments, of qualifying, only missing out due to the most bizarre of conclusions. Now, obviously, European Championships in those days, very, very tough to qualify for, even though they'd now expanded, of course, to 8 teams. You had to win your group. There was no second place, no playoff, none of that stuff. Wales had already had an incredible 4-4 draw in Yugoslavia, who were the group favourites, of course. And in the end, it came down to a home game against Yugoslavia. A home win that day would see Wales through, see them qualify. They did indeed take the lead, but then conceded a frustratingly soft equaliser 10 minutes from time. It was assumed, therefore, they were as good as out, with Yugoslavia expected to beat Bulgaria a week later at home and to take the qualifying place. But for a time, it was Bulgaria found themselves in pole position to go through with a win. But as a game neared its end, the fact the scores were actually level at this point meant Wales were through. That was still the case as the game was in stoppage time. Bulgaria then had a golden chance to win it, to qualify instead themselves. Missed it. Wales were still qualifying with literally seconds to go. Then Yugoslavia broke and scored with pretty much the last kick. Wales were briefly in, and then they were out again. Now, Reece, Euro 84 was a tournament that ultimately UK had no representation in it in the end. It's probably, again, I think, largely forgotten that Wales were the ones who came closer than any to qualifying. I think it's overshadowed in terms of 84 qualifier stories by Northern Ireland beating West Germany twice, for instance, by England getting beaten by the emergence of Denmark, Scotland being frankly awful. Maybe that was a bigger story. Is this a theme then, Reece? Wales not getting the credit they deserve, particularly in a case like this, which, you know, feel free to wax lyrical about this campaign. It was an incredible qualifying campaign that Wales so nearly made it through.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just the more that gets added to that canon, it's hard to focus on individual moments. So, you know, it's on the shelf of so many Welsh disappointments. How do you pick one of those out of there? But yeah, like you say, this one is particularly cruel, isn't it? So it's almost as if they were in it, out of it, in it again, out of it again. Yeah. So the 80th minute, 81st minute, maybe equaliser. As you said, soft against Yugoslavia. You know, you come to terms, you think, okay, well, you know, it's not going to happen. We've had a chance there. If you can't win at home, you know, maybe you don't deserve to go. And then the things that happen out in that final game, when really we're just, it's awkward, isn't it? When you're watching another team, you have no agency of what happens. You're not the first fans anyway. But when Wales are playing, at least I feel like, you know, although this was, you know, before my time, you know, I'm sure the fans there felt like they had some kind of say of what was happening. And then, yeah, you put it in the hands of Bulgaria to try and get the result against Yugoslavia.
Never a wise policy.
And they almost do. And again, we're there. And then the rug gets pulled away cruelly again. Yeah, it's just...
You'd almost rather that last game, Yugoslavia-Bulgaria, just gone how everyone thought. You know, a nice thumping win. One way or the other, probably wouldn't have mattered. Because then either way, Wales were out.
Absolutely. Save the palpitations. But that never happens, does it? Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing this podcast if it was straightforward. You know, as
very true.
When I was young, we were out of most qualifiers within a couple of games. You know, at least you made your peace with it. But you know, for the people maybe a generation younger than me, older than me, sorry, it seems particularly cruel, doesn't it?
Oh God, yeah. Stephen, what do you think to this one? I mean, it's just astonishing the way it went. But I guess, you know, am I right in why this and 82 were overshadowed? Is it just purely the Scotland thing?
I think it is. I think the shadow of the Scotland games just you know, cast across them. But for me, I think 84 is the great miss. It's the one that should have been. It changed so much, you know, for Wales that have, you know, 30 seconds in a different direction, and that's Wales going to France in 84. That's the UK getting to watch the tournament on television. That's a peak of the powers, you know, Wales, really. You know, that's Ian Rush on the back of 47 goals, having been part of a team that wins the league title, the League Cup and the European Cup. That's Neville Southall, who's just won the FA Cup with Everton. You know, this is you know, Merseyside on the crest of a wave and Wales being highly predominant for both. Kevin Ratcliffe at the back there as well. No, this is the great miss. This really is the great miss. You know, they are, you know, a midfielder of immense purpose away from having the perfect world-class spine. You know, Scotland had a Souness at this point in time. England had a Brian Robson. You know, that was the one thing that Wales were missing. They were missing that, you know, truly biblical central midfielder that would have completed the set there. And this is a team that feasibly could have done very well in France as well.
They'd have probably done better than Yugoslavia did, let's be honest.
Yeah, you know, they capitulated. The only game that Yugoslavia played quite well in was actually against France, held them to a 3-2, when it mattered very little, I think, by that time. Well, it did. In the last game, they were you know, categorically out of the tournament, and it was just a case of, you know, relaxing in that way that some teams do when they're already out of a tournament. But yeah, this for me, 84, I've always been fascinated with this near miss. You know, 9 minutes away from qualifying under their own steam in the game against Yugoslavia, and then a week later, you know, this gift is about to be presented to them when this cruel late blow hits them. And yeah, it is. This is the one that always resonates with me. But it is completely blindsided, you know, by the Scotland games of 77 and 85. And, you know, it shouldn't be the case, because this 84 is seriously the one that they came the closest to. Out of all those near misses, this was the one. And it would have changed so much as well. Like I say, watching the game from a British perspective, we were restricted to just two games live. You know, the West Germany-Spain game, the last group game, and the final itself. Everything else was, you know, highlights thrown on hastily after ITV had backed out. You know, if Wales were there, then we'd have got to see the greatest European Championship of all time in its entirety. Yet we didn't.
Yes, this is true. I mean, I wonder if it was also partly because this generation, I guess, in many people's minds, they were still emerging. You know, you mentioned their rush to Southall and so on, but there was more to come still, wasn't there, of world-class talent to come into the side that wasn't quite there yet at that point. So maybe it's because, also, as well as the Scotland thing, but in people's minds, the peak of that generation was actually a year or two still down the line. Whereas in actual fact, 82 and 84, they came far closer than they would do a few years later. I don't know. Just a possible theory. But it's such a disappointment. And you're right. How we could have had extra TV coverage, actual TV coverage of that tournament.
And I think they would have supplied a really cool kit to that tournament that would have stood up to all of the others as well. You know, that one with the sleeves and the white sleeve era.
White, I know, sleeve, exactly.
You know, and very similar to kind of like Denmark's, you know, kit. It would have been, yeah. I mean, that Yugoslavia kit, their Adidas one, was a pretty good one anyway. But I think Wales would have trumped that. Throw in the Denmark, the Belgium kits, and that classic France one that actually won it.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot to be said for the kits deciding the tournament.
In terms of style, both in style, terms of how they played and how they looked, Wales would have looked the part at the 1984 European Championship.
We're definitely in an era of Wales being the superior British nation kit, without doubt. I think England 82 has its credit, I think, but equally it went on too long.
Yeah, kitsch value, but the England kit that followed after that really sad, full-on looking umbro effort. It was shocking.
That Wales kit, the white sleeves one, and the one that came later in 84 with the stripes across the chest.
Yeah, that was nice. As well.
That was beautiful as well. Yeah,
they are probably two of alongside the Admiral one. Do you know what? This is a separate podcast entirely. those kits you still see now. You see the remakes in Cardiff City Stadium frequently. They haven't died out. I do think though, you're just to touch on something Stephen said there about the almost like a sliding doors moment. What would have happened? Would we have seen it more on TV? I can't help but think what that would have done for the growth of the game in Wales, because I think during that year of the 80s, as you've alluded to, we've got that Merseyside domination domestically, where Everton and Liverpool are the best teams. Rush, Southall, Ratcliffe, they're all so important to those teams. And there was almost a feeling of, you know, as close as we got, we were still never qualifying. And it was almost like those players were great and you'd see them in the FA Cup final and then it felt like they'd come back and slum it with Wales. And, you know, like Wales wasn't as professional an outfit, obviously, as Liverpool and Everton too. And I wonder, had they had that platform, had we qualified, had Wales have been more visible on that platform, you know, would that have pushed things on a little bit? Would we, you know, as an organisation, would we have been more professional? Would the game have more of a cultural base in Wales that rugby union enjoyed at the time? You know, would things have sped up? You know, would we be where we are now, maybe a generation sooner? You can't help but wonder. You could go crazy wondering about these things, I think. But
that's just getting tragic now, isn't it? Like the whole.
that's what I think of the table.
It is. It's one of the great what ifs, so isn't it? Because it's, you know, they'd have had the stage themselves as far as kind of like a UK perspective of concern, which would be very, very similar to kind of like Scotland flying solo at the 1974 and 78 World Cups. You know, they would have had, you know, the whole experience of kind of the all of that blanket coverage, all of that intensity of, you know, would have been quite something. But that for me, 84 is, you know, despite everything else, it's the serious one that got away. You know, there were other moments that could have gone Wales' way, but I also think they had the team and you know, that this really was kind of like peak Rush. You know, I don't think,
and you're absolutely right as well, that there'd never again be another opportunity for it to be just Wales.
Yeah, just Wales at that point in time.
That's not going to happen in modern times, is it? Not at all.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to imagine, you know, especially European Championships being made so much more expansive. You know, it's great to see Wales qualify for the European Championships the last two times, and then to do so well in 2016, of which obviously we'll come to in the last part of the series. But yeah, that opportunity, the more that, you know, finals tournaments grow in size in terms of how many nations are going to be at them, the chance to be the only UK representative at one of these is, you know, highly diminished.
Well, as we say, the mid-80s did see the emergence of this strong generation of world-class talent. It was a bit of a North Wales power base now, which I guess is a bit of a change from how it had been at many points in Welsh history. So Ian Rush, we mentioned him, from St Asaph in Denbighshire, Neville Southall from Llandudno, Kevin Radcliffe from Mancot in Flintshire, Mark Hughes from near Wrexham. This is, you know, this is some world-class talent we're talking about as well from these areas. Now, Stephen, you know, you mentioned Ian Rush, but, you know, I think we need to give him a bit of extra talk, because he was, I guess he was the first of this generation to emerge as well, slightly ahead of Southall, I think, but he was really one of the finest in the world for a time, wasn't he?
He really was. He was the most sought of, that's what I'm saying, like the summer of 84, you're talking about the most sought after striker in certainly in European football. You know, from the summer of 84, we were facing an uphill struggle to keep hold of him. We kept hold of him for another 3 years, but he was effectively sold in the summer of 86. But from the summer of 84, you know, the great and the good of Serie A were seriously battering down the door and trying to, you know, obtain him. You know, he was just a license to score goals. Like I say, 47 goals in all competitions in. You know, we always talk about Clive Allen's 49-goal season, 86-87. This was the high peak of Rush. It was 83-84, and he still hit well in the 30s, you know, all the seasons surrounding that year. He absolutely phenomenal, an unerring finisher, you know, as well. And I think that's the thing with Liverpool at the time. Everything was a centrally delivered ball to him. So many times you'd see the ball rolled through for him to run onto, whether that was from Dalglish, from a Molby, from a Paul Walsh, from a John Walk. And I think it's probably the one thing he didn't quite have with Wales. But, you know, he still scored the goals, you know, still broke that record goal scorer. I mean, Ivor Allchurch, I was fascinated by the name of Ivor Allchurch because it was the name that Rush was chasing at that point in time for the record goal scorer, you know, for Wales. And he was just an absolute phenomenon. He was never quite the same player when he came back from Juventus. You know, I think he tried to do one of these things where it's like grow as a player and have a more all-round game. And he did in a way, but it took a little bit of his essence away from him just being that utterly ruthless, you know, goal scorer. You know, that utterly focused, ruthless goal scorer, which is what he was. You know, and that's the version of Rush that Wales would have been able to take to the 1984 European Championships or the 1982 or the 1986 World Cup. You know, he was just an absolute phenomenon.
I always wonder how the dynamic was between him and Neville Southall when they met up for Wales, and Kevin Ratcliffe, I guess, to some extent, but Southall more, because the number of goals he put past Everton, particularly on one famous occasion at Goodison, I think, when he got four in one game. You do wonder how that went, although I did see something with Rush, who was very much at pains to say, just think how many goals I would have had against Everton if they didn't have been for Southall,
yeah. Well, there used to be a similar thing on Merseyside between Elisha Scott and Dixie Dee. So it was like a reverse roles of that. It was the Liverpool goalkeeper and the Everton striker back in the 30s. And the old urban legend about how Dixie Dean and was walking down the road one time and saw Elisha Scott and nodded towards him as a way of saying hello, and Scott dives into the gutter thinking the ball's coming, you know, flashback type of thing. But yeah, it must have made for some interesting training sessions, you know, if Rush is being allowed to drill the ball past Southall several times. But Southall, you know, just the best goalkeeper in British football at that point in time. And for me, best goalkeeper in European football at that time. You know, that a lot of challenges, Dacier, Pfaff, you know, Tony Schumacher, you know, billed as the great mellifluous, you know, villain of the piece because of what he did to Patrick Battiston in 82. Yet behind all of that Bond villain-esque, you know, pantomime lay a very good goalkeeper. You know, and these are the contemporaries of Southall. These are the names that you're not holding Southall up to. You're holding them up to Southall. You know, talk about Rush being a phenomenon, you know, as far as goal scoring is concerned. You know, Southall, an absolute phenomenon as far as keeping the ball out of the net.
If you had those two in the squad, plus, as we say, Kevin Ratcliffe, also of Everton, very classy, stylish defender. Maybe less classy Pat Vandenhoe, but we don't need to go into that one. But you've got Mark Hughes, of course, from Manchester United, and his predilection for spectacular goals. I mean, it's a stellar lineup in parts. And I guess this is what questions coming in a sec, Reece, is that it's such a change from world stars on one hand, and then you've got ordinary, I don't know, you know, average players for the rest of the team. It's kind of a fascinating setup. There's something very appealing about teams that end up with the real elite, which is what we're talking about here, plus the more ordinary mixed in together. It's a really interesting mix of how that works, how it looks. It always seems appealing and fun as an observer, but you do wonder how it is within the team, whether it's frustrating, whether it causes issues of balance in the team, or whether it's just simply great to have world stars to go on top of the rest.
Yeah, it must be an interesting dynamic. It must have been a fly on the wall when, you know, Mark Hughes, I would imagine he hits those volleys in training with even more regularity than, you know, in games. And there's players who can't do that. And then what are his expectations of those players around him? You know, Mark Hughes, Southall, Rush, the ones you've already named. I think a lot falls then on the coaching staff to create the dynamic where people are comfortable each other's presence and people are not intimidated, and yeah, that you get the best out of a team spirit. I think, you know, that's been the case for Wales due to the size of the nation since we've played football. We spoke about it in the 70s, even in modern day times. So by the time this goes out, the 26-man squad will be announced, and there's, you know, not to jump ahead an episode, but there's a lot of speculation that there'll be League Two players involved in this. But I don't think there's ever a suggestion in modern times that those players feel out of place. It'd be interesting to know what it was like at the time, maybe where the setup was less professional. Players like Hughes, Rush, maybe they had higher expectations of what was happening in camp. And yeah, maybe that did lead to some tension.
I wonder, what do you think, Stephen? I think there's a comparison to, I know we'll come on to the 90s soon, but obviously Ryan Giggs emerged at that point as another world star. You don't ever get the impression that he was as committed to it all or as willing to muck in with the ordinary, if you like, in the same way that these guys were.
Yeah, I'd imagine with Giggs, it, there was a certain overbearing figure, you know, at his club.
True.
That had a say in that and maybe directed some of that. You know, maybe there were times when he'd have liked to have gone and played, you know, in the games that he was, you know, unavailable for. You know, certainly earlier on, I'm sure over a period of time, it just normalised as an entity as such. But I mean, I always remember kind of like the Merseyside players going off to play for Wales. There was never any, there was never any sounds of kind of, I don't know, kind of like resentment over a lack of professionalism or anything to do with, you know, conditions or, you know, payments or, you know, accommodation when they're away and stuff like that. I think there was an enormous pride. That was the thing that always struck. Anytime that Rush, you know, would talk about going playing for Wales, it was with an enormous sense of pride. And I think that's, you know, very distinct, I think, to the Welsh national football team and to other branches of sport in Wales as well, in that it's much more passionate than it is for some of the others. I mean, Scotland at times can match it maybe or contend with it, but certainly nothing that is stirred within the England squad, I don't think, apart from the occasional tub thumper like a Terry Butcher or something like that. It's not across the board in the way that it seems. But yeah, you know, I think Southall was another, and Ratcliffe, there was always, no matter what they did at club level, you know, they were as proud as going playing for Wales as they were of going out there and winning a league title or an FA Cup or a, you know, a European trophy. You know, going back to Southall, you know, what I would say is that, you know, he was that good that, you know, if he'd have been born half an hour further up the coast, he'd have by 84, 85, he'd have dislodged Peter Shilton from that England number one shirt without a shadow of a doubt. You know, whereas say that Wales, you know, were potentially missing a midfielder of immense purpose away from the perfect spine, then, you know, what a Southall might have done for an England side that, you know, were going to Mexico in 86 or Italy in 1990, and the difference that he would have made, a goalkeeper of that calibre at the peak of his powers. But yeah, it was always that sense of pride. Joey Jones, even going back to Joey Jones, who was still involved in the mid-80s for Wales, and the fact that, you know, even when he dropped down to play for Huddersfield in the second division, and, you know, he was forever, and Mickey Thomas was another one that always come across that way as well. You know, they just absolutely loved playing for Wales. It was never a chore. And I think that's the striking thing. So yeah, that combination of kind of like the great and the good of the likes of the Russians and the Southalls and all those, alongside kind of like players from lower levels. I think there's almost the opportunity there or the propensity to be the great equaliser. The big name players being the inspiration for the players from down the divisions to you know, to play alongside and to be part of something with.
Well, let's move on into the 1986 World Cup qualifiers then. So as in 1978, Wales were in a group with Scotland, more of them shortly, plus Spain and, of course, their 1982 nemesis, Iceland. It's probably the group of death as far as Wales are concerned, really, in terms of past demons coming back. Now, Rhys, this campaign will obviously be remembered for quite a few reasons. There's firstly the disastrous start in losing 1-0 to Iceland. I guess that will come back to haunt them again. The spectacular Mark Hughes volley that we alluded to earlier, and the 3-0 win over Spain in Wrexham. There was a win in Scotland too before it came down to the home match with Scotland with a playoff place on the line. This time it was played in Wales, Ninian Park in Cardiff. So that's a good thing. But I mean, it was an incredible campaign, dramatic throughout from a Welsh perspective, right up to the last.
Yeah, again, echoes of previous campaigns. Closer than 78. I think to go back to what Stephen said, I think 78 is kind of lamented over because of Joe Jordan's handball, because of the sense of injustice. But like you say, you know, in the cold light of day, maybe it wasn't as close. But yeah, 85 in Ninian Park is right up there. And I think, yeah, I guess we did get closer there. It's a game that's obviously overshadowed by what happened to Jock Stein afterwards. And I think that kind of, everyone who's interviewed from that era references that and says that, you know, his death obviously put a put everything into perspective there. Still, actually, there's a plaque, so the new Cardiff City Stadium is built around the same area of Ninian Park, and the Ninian Park gates are still there. There's a plaque on there that says that marks the date, and I think the phraseology is Jock Stein leaving the world of football, leaving the field of football for the last time. And yeah, I suppose things, a genuine tragedy, puts into the perspective all the, you know, we throw the word tragedy out quite often, don't we?
Definitely in the sporting context, but yeah, this was obviously a bit different. I mean, again, a penalty for Scotland is what it comes down to as well, wasn't it? Another tragic figure, Davy Cooper, was the one who scored it on this game. Another one taken well before his time. All right, Stephen, I mean, this was painful again, I guess, in the dramatic way it came about. Was this Wales generation, or is this just my 80s bias coming in? You know, we've talked about the great players of this time. Was this, though, the strongest collection of world-class talent that Wales has ever had? I know other teams have done better more recently, obviously, and they've got one or two world-class players in recent times, and they've had others further back too. Was this the peak of it, though?
I think so, and that might be me kind of, like, you know, doing the same thing and favouritism towards my era of football, kind of like, yeah, just being completely absorbed by it. But no, I do. I think that, no, this to have one, you know, world class player or two is something, but this is a Wales side with at least four. You know, Mark Hughes has grown into himself a lot more by the 85-86 World Cup qualifiers. That goal he scores against Spain at the racecourse is incredible. Still to watch now. You know, Rush scores two that night, but, you know, that brace is overshadowed massively by this wondrous goal that Mark Hughes scores. You know, it's just so spectacular.
In a lovely kit, as we say.
In such a lovely kit. But yeah, for me, this is Pete Wales, you know, of that era anyway. You know, you can't, you know, ignore what the contemporary Wales is doing now, and with some fine players as well. But yeah, this is the Wales for me. You know, the 84 and 86 is the Wales.
There's a great balance that perhaps we don't, maybe now, but I guess we'll get on to this, but 2016 is a team that's competent, that is led by two, maybe three superstars, whereas this 80s team, just to look at it written down, there's a great balance. You know, in all positions, there's quality.
There's that balance. I mean, and while I say that they were missing a truly class midfielder of purpose, I'm talking about that higher echelon, someone who could match the level that the Southalls and the Rushes and the Hughes and the Ratcliffes were playing at. They had good midfielders, but they didn't quite have that great midfielder. Like, they had a great, you know, two great strikers and a, you know, great goalkeeper and a great central defender. But yeah, the balance was wonderful, because Nicholas is an underrated midfielder. Thomas was still knocking around; he could still turn it on. And this, you know, was again another, you know, fantastic opportunity. You know, they'd lost two qualifiers to start with, but then they'd won three on the spin before going into the Scotland game. So, you know, they played themselves into that magnificent chance, and again, it was lost.
You say play themselves into it. I mean, this is, how does a team go from losing 1-0 to Iceland? And this wasn't maybe as strong as some other Icelandic generations we were sort of talking before, to beating Spain 3-0. I mean, that's, in a short space of time, an astonishing turnaround, inconsistency, or however you want to refer to it. I don't know, to be capable of performances and results like that one over Spain must add to the frustration of the whole thing.
Yeah, just that, it adds to that mythology reference at the start of getting up for the big games, and then just, is it a lack of concentration, preparation? What is it? Maybe the fact that the Iceland game was up first. I don't know, maybe they took their eye off the ball. But then, yeah, it is totally at odds with that win over Spain. You know, such style, such aplomb with, you know, with that Hughes goal. It's great if you're watching now. He hits it with such ferocity. I can't remember if it's the connection of the ball, or if it's the ball going into net. The cameraman doesn't quite pick it up. Something's a little bit out of sync. Like, you either don't see him connecting with it fully, or you don't see the ball hitting the net just because of how quick it is. Yeah, that was a great moment. it's true what you say, isn't it? It's just the lack of consistency, which is a theme for generations. It doesn't make it any less frustrating, though.
And I'd say there's arguably potential for a bit of a hangover there as well, to come so close to qualifying for 84 in the European Championships. And then, you know, before 1984 is over, you're going into the qualifiers for the next major international tournament. And there they are, they lose the opening two. I kind of, you know, I get that. I do, you know, subscribe to that concept of the hangover. A team, you know, whether it's a club level, they miss out on glory at the end of one season. And they take that disappointment into the start of the following season. I think there's a little bit of that behind Wales' slow start to the 1986 qualifiers. Is that there's just that, I don't know, that brooding hangover just hanging over them, thinking just so close to getting to those finals. And then, God, we've got to raise ourselves now for the qualifiers now. But even down to that final qualifier against Scotland, the early goal that Wales get, and then there are other chances. Everything seemed to be falling in Wales' direction. That fateful night for 45 minutes. You know, one goal, they should have had two, maybe even three. Scotland lost Jim Leighton at half time to a lost contact lens,
yes.
Of all things. So for Scotland to have to throw on Alan Ruff, you know, it just seemed, you know, destined to be Wales until this incident with the penalty. And then obviously what happened after the match just kind of like changed. You know, the whole view of that night and that game for people. That, you know, I think, you know, just how well Wales played that night does get lost in that. You know, the whole, I don't know, the whole panorama of that evening. You know, as it unfolds.
Well, those close campaigns of the early and mid 1980s, they drifted away, I guess, to tougher times as the decade came to an end. The 88 Euros qualifiers, they began with a draw in Finland, but Wales performed pretty well, really, in a tough group. And then going into the final matches, they were in a great position to qualify. But the two they had to play were the two strongest teams of the group. So Wales ended up losing to both their main rivals, Denmark and Czechoslovakia, and missed out. 1990 World Cup was even tougher. Wales drawn to face the Netherlands and West Germany. The Netherlands are European champions at the time. West Germany semi-finalists from that and about to become world champions. As group draws go, that's about as horrific as it gets. There was an admirable 0-0 draw with West Germany, but the only other point came in a draw with Finland, and Wales finished last. So not the best of qualifiers, but there were better times coming. Wales were soon on the up again. Terry Yorath had now taken over as coach for the Euro 1992 and 1994 World Cup qualifiers, where there would be plenty of drama. We've already mentioned Ryan Giggs, so he'd emerge by now as well to add a bit of his youthful skills to those of the now old-timers still in the squad. So, Rhys, in this Euros qualifying, we'll come on to 1994 and all that drama shortly, but in the Euros qualifying, to add to that 0-0 draw they had with West Germany in the 1990 qualifiers, now against just Germany, an incredible win at Cardiff Arms Park in these qualifiers, plus a friendly win over Brazil as well. This was heady days. They went really, really close, but overall, despite missing out at this point, it was a positive time for Wales. Was playing at the Cardiff Arms Park a help to this or a hindrance?
Yeah, do you know, I rewatched this game fairly recently. If you remember, right, in the early days of lockdown, prior to even football coming back behind closed doors, BBC Wales were repeating certain games, and that was the first one chosen. So the Unified Germany in the National Stadium. So that's the point, actually. So it's called the National Stadium. Commonly remembered as Cardiff Arms Park, but a little bit of trivia for you guys. Cardiff Arms Park is actually the adjoining rugby field where Cardiff RFC play. So it's become one of those things where it's known as that, but officially always called the National Stadium of Wales. So when that was knocked down, stadium, they actually turned the pitch 90 degrees, and it's still attached now to the other side. So if you go to watch Cardiff RFC play rugby, you have this huge looming Millennium Stadium over the top of you. But yeah, that must have been a conscious decision, I guess, to move to the bigger ground, I guess, to give some gravitas to the team. You know, we were playing particularly attractive opponents, if you like, world champions, and then Brazil, whose stock never really goes down. And yeah, but, you know, great results as well. I think that's the first time we were really experimenting with Hughes, Rush and Dean Saunders all playing at the same time. So I say, you know, Hughes, you know, still very, I'm not quite sure when Mark Hughes' prime was, because I remember watching him, you know, at Chelsea in the mid to late 90s, still thinking he was an incredible player. But Rush was a little bit past his prime, and an emerging Dean Saunders. And it felt like we had this new batch of exciting players, and there was excitement around the team, and you just wanted to play all your best players. I think it was Saunders that actually scored the winner against Brazil in that game of the same era. So yeah, you're right. There was excitement around it. Gigs as well. An exciting young team. What was to come in the mid-90s, I'm sure we'll get on to in a little bit. I guess it didn't really live up to it. And these are my formative years as a Welsh fan. So I was born in 86, and the mid-90s is really when I took an interest. So I'm sure we'll come to that.
Yes, this positive spell didn't last. I mean, I guess this, as you say there, Rhys, this was an upsurge where there was a mixture of the old guard, as you say, not necessarily all in their prime, but still very much to the fore. You know, Rush and Southall maybe slightly past their peak, but still performing very, very well. Rush obviously scored that great winner against Germany in that qualifier. But then, yeah, the emerging talent. So Ryan Giggs, obviously, there's Gary Speed as well coming through at this time. Some real quality. Could this, Stephen, have been a real sweet spot then for Wales, potentially? And we'll come on to 1994 in a sec. But, you know, in terms of the generation, the mix of the old and the new, world-class talent at both ends of the scale.
Yeah, I'd still class those 80s, 84 and 86 as being bigger misses. Because, I mean, obviously they come so close in 94. And again, you know, that lack of luck within the draw as well, to draw the Netherlands and West Germany for the 1990 qualifiers, it was just brutal.
You know, that's you may brutal. As well just give up.
That is brutally unfair, considering, you know, how well they played, and just the vagaries of the seeding system as well. But to bounce back from that, I mean, I think I remember like the sacking of Mike England, and everyone, you know, a lot of people had a lot of sympathy for him because he'd come so close to taking Wales to major international tournaments on multiple occasions, and it would be something that would be kind of revisited with Terry Yorath, you know, and just left with this feeling that you've dispensed with a good man here and shot yourselves in the foot. But yeah, the 92 qualifiers, I mean, again, it's another very Wales type of thing to happen, to draw Germany, the last 8-team European Championship. So the last time that only the group winners are going through. And Wales finish a creditable and comfortable second to Germany in those qualifiers. Something that would have been, you know, comfortably enough to get them to the next European Championship. So there's a little bit of a symmetry there with the 1976 European Championship in that, you know, here they are reaching the quarterfinals, the last eight of the last, you know, 4-team European Championships. Here they are finishing, you know, not a massively distant second to Germany in the 1992 qualifiers, but, you know, it's not yet a 16-team tournament. You know, Wales are just a nation, but across these qualifiers, after this span of time, these 2 decades in particular, 3 decades, 70s, 80s and 90s.
Were it's getting worse just, by the second.
The right team in the wrong place, you know, but looking sartorially elegant and blessed with some outrageous talent.
Oh, dear. Yes, this is true. Well, let's get to some more misfortune then. The 1994 World Cup group came down to a final match with Romania, a team who had beaten Wales 5-1 at the start of the group, but Wales had recovered from that magnificently to get into a position towards the end of group where qualification was in their hands. They went behind in this game at home to Romania, again at the National Stadium, at the Arms Park. In a 2 or 3 minute spell in the second half, though, that could have changed everything. First of all, Dean Saunders, he equalised. Then Wales, only a minute or two later, got themselves a penalty. Now, this was the same dramatic night of qualifiers across Europe. It was an incredible, incredible day. So this is the day where France were falling apart in Paris to miss out. The two Irish sides were playing in Belfast, I think. European champions Denmark were losing to their nemesis, Spain. England were being humiliated within 8 seconds against San Marino. I remember watching in my university accommodation, and the coverage switched from England in San Marino and what on earth was going on there to Cardiff and Wales against Romania, just in time for the main drama. Rhys, put yourself in Paul Bowden's shoes as he stepped up to take that penalty in Cardiff. I mean, what might have been there?
Well, this is the thing. I think he, who else had the courage to put themselves in his shoes? It's such a daunting prospect to have the pressure on you to, you know, fire them ahead. We'll never know, but you assume had we taken the lead there, that could have been that. Yeah, it's one of the most remembered referenced moments when we qualified in 2016. The Manic Street Preachers released a single celebrating it, and Paul Bolden's penalty miss is a lyric in that song. I think what's forgotten is Neville Southall. As much as we've waxed lyrical about his athleticism, his agility, is just, you know, being probably our best ever goalkeeper. He's a fault for the first goal, without a doubt. Hadji's goal squirms under him, a really out of character mistake there, which kind of, I guess, puts the pressure on Paul Bolden there. Doesn't look confident, does he, as he strides up and he wallops the hell out of it. You know, at least he didn't try and Panenka. It's not an apologetic penalty. He tries to boot the leather off the ball and, yeah, crashes off the crossbar, and with it sends our hopes into the Cardiff sky, because we know what came afterwards. This is the first one I remember as well. Vaguely remember. What I actually remember is the BBC Wales adverts prior to the game, where we use the Andy Williams "Can't Take My Eyes Off You" song, which has become like an anthem now for the terraces. In times of triumph rather than in times of heartbreak. Yeah, I remember the build up to the game, and it's a popular BBC Wales advert. Yeah, I guess we can laugh about it now. But that's the first heartbreak I vaguely remember.
Wow. Okay, great. I mean, it takes 3 decades sometimes to get over these things, I find. I mean, this was a great Romania team, however, that Wales pushed to the limit there. I mean, the extra bit to the story is that Raducanu got a winner, I think, for Romania later on, as he would score several that summer in the USA in the World Cup, as Romania got themselves the quarterfinals and within a penalty shootout. Ironically, penalties causing them some issues in the World Cup within that of a semi-final. I mean, that's got to make you wonder, Stephen, doesn't it, how Wales could have done, because Romania were a very, very good team and did really, really well. I know it doesn't quite, you know, you can't just neatly replace one with the other, but you've got to wonder that.
It is one of those great what-ifs. I mean, Wales, I suppose, go into to 94, they'd have been amongst the lower seeded teams, but they'd have been like one of the most dangerous ones, simply on the back of the fact they hadn't qualified for a World Cup for so long. It would have been like Denmark were marooned in the bottom set of seeds for the 1986 World Cup draw. You know, Wales would have been sat there in a bottom pot as being, you know, the nation that no one wanted to draw from that pot. You know, cause like you say, you know, there was still an Ian Rush. Not the Ian Rush of old, but, you know, there was a, you know, Hughes was still there, Saunders, you know, yes, Southall, who's starting to kind of like be, you know, that little bit more rotund than he used to be, a little bit less agile. But yeah, there's Gary Speed in there too. But there's some absolute cloggers as well. It would have been, you know, again, they'd have had the floor as well. This was a chance to... You know, Ireland aren't, you know, Ireland are Ireland, you know, so this would have been Wales, you know, as far as a UK perspective, being the sole representative. You know, this again was the golden opportunity. But yeah, I think for me, although it's that romanticism, but 84, 86 kind of outweighs. I don't know whether it's just because I was still at school at that point in time. By 94, I'm a grown up and expected to kind of like earn wages and stuff like that, and you're viewing football somewhat differently than you were as a carefree kind of like 12-year-old. But yeah, it is one of the great what ifs. You know, where exactly would Wales have fitted into that 1994 World Cup, because they wouldn't have taken Romania's place directly, because Romania had been there 4 years earlier, so they wouldn't have necessarily had, you know, Romania's draw. You can't supplant one for the other. You know, you can try and plot where they might have been in that draw and who they might have gone up against, but, you know, within that, you know, 1994, it's the last 24 team World Cup, so, you know, 4 third place teams can go through. There's every chance that Wales... Enough quality players in that Wales team at the time, but to push that Romania side to so close, no, Georgi Hadji, you know, Dumitrescu, you know, Raducanu, Dan Petrescu. You know, Gica Popescu. You know, there's so many fantastic players in that side, you know, to come to within a sliding door of replacing them at that 1994 World Cup is a hell of an achievement. But for the struggles that would come for the next decade, which it did, you know, it was a decade of utter toil, but it was self-inflicted toil that was to come. Because I think that dispensing of Terry Yorath was just so reactionary and unnecessary.
Well, yes, the Terry Yorath era did come to an end following this defeat, with his contract not renewed. This, well, as Stephen alludes to there, this understandably angered many Welsh fans, given how well the team had been doing under him. John Toshack came in initially on a part-time basis while he was still managing Real Sociedad. He quit after one match, which was a 3-1 defeat to Norway, and the team were booed off, I guess, as much about the dismissal of Yorath as it was also about that defeat. Englishman Mike Smith then took over. He'd also coached the team in the early, mid to late 70s, sorry. So it's not as if he was a total outsider to Welsh football at all. The qualifiers for Euro 1996 were a struggle, which I guess the shame of timing that we talk about, isn't it? You know, the other campaigns, Wales would have got in to a 16-team tournament, but as soon as it was a 16-team tournament, Wales weren't quite at that level anymore. So those qualifiers were a struggle. Smith was then replaced with Bobby Gould, whose main qualification for the job, as far as I can see, seemed to simply be that he was available. I can't really see much beyond that. His four-year reign saw little success and an awful lot of fallings out. There was a fight with John Hartson on the training ground, arguments with Robbie Savage and Mark Hughes, and worst of all, Nathan Blake refusing to play after accusing Gould of making a racist remark in training. And we haven't even mentioned Vinnie Jones yet. Now, Rhys, a bit of an understatement to say this wasn't a particularly good time for Wales. Now, as you say, that 1993 game with Paul Bowden's penalty still racing up into the sky off the crossbar as we speak, probably. But this is where you're gaining more attention. You're absorbing a bit more of it as we come into this time. And it was pretty bad. I guess this is an easy question. First of all, was it a mistake to get rid of Yorath? Because aside from just simply Yorath and how well he was doing, you know, there's the players that come into that too, of course. It kicked off a series of short-term and poor managerial appointments.
Yeah, I think behind the scenes with Terry Yorath, I think he'd lost his son just the year that we didn't qualify. I think he was, you know, suffering a lot of problems. His personal life, obviously the bereavement there would have a huge effect, and I think he was massively affected by the failure to qualify. That loss, you know, I guess scarred him, as it did many of us. So I understand. I can forgive them not renewing. I don't know how it would have gone had he have stayed. But when you added the name Bobby Gould, it sent a shiver down my spine. That these were my formative years. These were when I watched every Wales game religiously. And this is where your editing skills are really going to have to come in, so we don't align to stand here. But I could not stand the man.
Hold back, Rhys. This is therapy.
I've needed a platform to get this off my chest for years. In a way, I understand the FAW appointing, in theory, someone like Gould, somebody who could maybe improve the spirit of the camp. Obviously, he was famously the Wimbledon coach some 7 years prior, almost in 1988, coached them to the FA Cup win. And there was a mythology around that team, you know, the kind of like us against the world, last gang in town kind of identity. And I can see how that would appeal to a national team where, you know, you get what you got. You've got superstars. You've got League Two players or the Division Three, whatever the equivalent. And you've got to mash together a group of misfits and improve the spirit. The problem was that everyone hated him. so it is tough. You know, if you're squaring off with John Hartson, a man 25 years younger than you, twice your size, in a wrestling match, I'm not sure how that's meant to improve spirit other than to galvanize everyone against you as the coach. But there's so many stories of the Bobby Gould era. There's playing like Norient in a friendly and losing. There's playing Cumbrian Town, so a place just outside Newport, where he actually subbed himself on in that game and scored a header from a Ryan Giggs cross. This is a man who is from Coventry, does not qualify for Wales in any way, yet decided to put himself in that position, making Vinnie Jones captain. So Vinnie Jones, a man who describes himself as very British, very pro-monarchy and very conservative. So if anyone knows anything about Welsh football fans and their politics and identity, this is like the antithesis of a man you want wearing the Welsh captain's armband. And above all, I just felt like he made us a huge laughing stock. It seemed like he never took the job seriously. Or the things he was serious about, he just channeled his energy in weird ways. So hanging out Robbie Savage to dry after Robbie Savage in a joke, kind of, I don't know if it was Soccer AM or whatever the show would have been at the time, he threw Maldini's shirt in the bin. And then Bobby Gould drags Robbie Savage into a press conference, a really young Robbie Savage, and just humiliates him in front of the world's press. Totally unnecessary. There's a man who's going to come back into your team, who you have to build a relationship with, who he's just humiliated in front of everyone. And yeah, he just made us such a huge laughing stock. I remember at the time, the Manic Street Preachers had just released an album called Everything Must Go. Played a gig in the CIA, Cardiff International Arena, and changed the lyrics to Bobby Gould Must Go. Such was the energy against the man. It was a really unpopular appointment. But yeah, when he did leave, finally, I think I can't imagine any Welsh fan was really disappointed by that. Sorry, Bobby.
But what do you really think, Rhys?
Yeah, do you want the next episode? I'll take the gloves off.
Exactly. Oh, it was an incredible time. You're right. It did make it a bit of a laughing stock. It was newsworthy of just the sheer farce of some of the situations. I mean, Stephen, what was less likely to you, Bobby Gould being an international manager or Vinnie Jones as an international player?
Oof. Yeah, that's a tough call. That's a tough call. That, I mean, at least Vinnie Jones had, you know, the surname to fit the remit.
But Welsh, yeah, Bobby, wasn't it?
Yeah, but Bobby Gould was yeah, absolutely left field. You know, and bringing in Vinnie Jones, I think it was just taking a leaf out the Jack Charlton's approach to leading Ireland, wasn't it? It was let's have a look at your family tree and is there any way we can crowbar you into the team? You know, you can't. You know, it wasn't halcyon days. I mean, considering what had just passed, you know, in relatively recent times at that point in time, and I mean, as well, this is kind of like the total polar opposite. I think it was when Mike England went and Wales were linked with Brian Clough taking the job on a part-time basis. Now, there's another great what-if of the Wales national side, is if Brian Clough, you know, having famously passed over for the England job, had been handed the Wales job. But yeah, I think there was it was deemed a reluctance to leave. Oh, you know, he was, you know, never going to leave Nottingham Forest, so it had to be, you know, a job sure. You know, it was going to be a part-time job done on the side of what he was doing with Forest. But again, it's another fascinating what if.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. The change in fortune is astonishing. And has there, Rhys, ever been a more depressing period in Welsh, recent anyway, Welsh football history, like in your memory? That would be an easy one, but over the course of all the times we've been talking about, is this as bad as it got?
I was going to joke then that you don't need the word football in there. It could be the worst period of Welsh history. I won't get into that. It was a dark time. I can't foresee a worse product on the field. And even like Steve mentioned, picking Vinnie Jones because he had a Welsh surname. Like, there is a way to do that. There is a diaspora of Welsh people who, you know, it happens now, who've left Wales, whose parents have an affinity with Wales, who have a connection to the national side, to the nation. But it just felt like that was a case of Bobby Gould disrespects all the centre backs in Wales and just chooses his mate because yeah, sounds a bit Welsh.
See, what we could do, we could tag on an extra episode of Joneses that would have been better than Vinny to take on a role in the Welsh national team. I mean, Gloria Jones, you know, with Tom Jones, I think anyone would have been better.
I was going to say, my Welsh surname and Welsh heritage, you should have picked me at the time. I'd have been no worse. At least my granddad could speak Welsh.
Would you beat him in a wrestling match? And I would, like, it was easy for John Charlton. Would you fancy your chances there?
Well, we'll see. Yeah, a strange time indeed, but at least the decade ended on a more positive note. Bobby Gould was gone, hooray, and Mark Hughes took over, partnered with Neville Southall for one match initially, then taking sole charge. We'll obviously come more into this in the next episode of What Happens Next, but Rhys, was it important to have somebody back in charge who, given what had just come and everything we've just said about Bobby Gould, who wasn't only Welsh but was also a Welsh football legend, did that feel almost necessary as a sort of antidote to what had just been?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anyone would have been an improvement, but it's such a stark contrast, isn't it? It's Bobby Gould, who'd seemingly been out of football forever. You know, it's a different generation since his Wimbledon team. And then Mark Hughes was still playing at a high level. So I think he still would have been a Blackburn player at the time. So, you know, playing at a high level, thought of highly by the Welsh public. Yeah, I think it was a no-brainer, wasn't it? It's an interesting era in Wales as well. So this is, you know, in 97 was devolution, the establishment of the Welsh Assembly. And it's a term that's thrown around a lot now, but at the time we referred to it as Cool Cymru. So the Manic Street Preachers were in the prime. There's a band from Aberdeen called the Stereophonics who were popular. Catatonia, it was cool to be Welsh again. Later in the decade, they've sort of the 1999 Rugby World Cup, National Stadium's demolished. We rebuild the Millennium Stadium, this, you know, incredible city centre, cathedral of sport that was, it isn't highly thought of in the modern era by Welsh football fans, but at the time, it was just a really exciting time. And with Mark Hughes at the helm, yeah, things were great, particularly for that the opening part of that that Euro 2004 qualifying campaign. Sorry, 2002.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And we will come on to all that in our next episode, of course. But I mean, hope for the future here, Stephen. You know, sometimes you have to hit rock bottom, don't you, to start climbing up again?
Oh, completely. I think this is a period of time where they very nearly dropped into three figures as far as kind of like FIFA rankings were, because they're down in the 70s, certainly. Was there not some like a 4-0 or a 5-0 against Moldova or something, which would seriously rock bottom? You know, and it was a succession of shooting themselves in the foot from, you know, which just seemed to stem from the firing of Yorath. This brief flirtation of Toshak, this, you know, the bringing back of Mike Smith, which just seemed really, really strange at the time, and then the whole Bobby Gould experiment. Which, you know, sounds like it should be a band that John Peel was playing on late night Radio 1. I think there was definitely an air of, well, how much worse can it seriously get if we give, you know, one of the stars of the past who's still kicking a ball around the job? Well, you know, what worse things can happen? You know, we can't exactly burn water, so let's give this a chance. And to be fair, it's the genesis of what's to come, though.
Yeah, absolutely. There was hope for the future. I hate to think what kind of music the Bobby Gould experience would have come up with. It would not have been
It'd have been unlistenable. It'd have been like Yoko Ono or something like that. There'd have been a lot of screeching and prayer, primeval kind of like stuff.
I could be the front man of that band, just screaming into the void with that era.
Just why? Why?
There'd be no super furry animals, put it that way.
Okay, well, let's round things off for this episode then. A little quick fire finish for you both. Of all the legends we've mentioned in today's episode through the 80s and 90s, who was the best player for Wales? Now, that's not necessarily the same as being the best player for your club. Who was the best player for Wales? Who wants to go first?
Well, without sounding partisan, I mean, Rush does score goals, and he breaks the record, and, you know, he gets the goal against Germany, and, you know, he scores some massively high profile goals and stuff, which is epic. But, you know, if you're looking for kind of like a true embodiment of carrying Wales on your sleeve, you know, it's got to be a Joey Jones, really. You know, such an icon, such a cult hero. You know, so committed, could play in a variety of positions as well, and actually, you know, understated, you know, player. He eventually switched to central defender when he lost his speed to play at fullback. And you know, throughout the fluctuations of his career, to go from Wrexham to Liverpool and then back, drop back down to Wrexham, eventually played for Chelsea, dropped off and played for Huddersfield, went back to Chelsea again, I think. And, you know, despite these, you know, almost like a footballing Andre Agassi in that respect, you know, the peaks were only, you know, he could only truly enjoy the peaks because there's been a trough interspersed between them. So yeah, for me, it's got to be someone like a Joey Jones or someone like that. Someone who just would have properly, you know, bled for the team.
Very good, Reese. How about you?
I'd go the other end of the field. I'd probably choose Big Nev. Just for length of service. I remember him when I was first starting to watch the team. Still, just that man between the sticks is, you know, aside from the Hadji goal, just the agility, the kind of. As long as you've got a good goalkeeper, you relax and you can enjoy football a little bit more. Yeah, such a stalwart of the team. So many great performances, particularly the, we lost 7-1 out in Eindhoven and he got the Man of the Match award for that. So that just shows, you can imagine where we would have been without him. And then since, odd quirk of the Welsh team, since Southworth came into the team, I don't think we've had a South Walian goalkeeper since. So it'd have been Southall, Paul Jones, Wayne Hennessy, Danny Ward, all North Walians, even Di Davis before. So I don't know what they do up there. I don't think they're taller than us down here. But yeah, that's there must be something in the water up in North Wales.
Yeah, it must be something to do with slate. That's all I can guess. Something to do with slate. Anyway, I think one more then.
So I just throw in there as well. One of the ironic things is with Wales missing out on the 1986 World Cup is that Southall wouldn't have been able to go. You know, that horrific ankle injury that he sustained again a game against Ireland or something like that, I think in the March of 86 would have kept him out of the 1986 World Cup. So in a way, you know, again, that's another nod towards 84, is that would have been Southall's big eye of the storm, peak of his powers tournament for him to have played him.
Well, on that note, the final question is, which qualifying disappointment stings the most? Now, Stephen, you can't pick two of have 82 and 84. You've got to pick one of them.
Oh, 84. To come within seconds, you know, is absolute torture, really. You know, even down to kind of like relying on a result from someone else. That's how Ireland got there in 88. You know, Scotland went to Sofia and picked up an unexpected win against Bulgaria. And Ireland, who'd finished their fixtures, were top of the table and were expecting to be knocked off the top of the table and had this pleasant surprise. And in a way, that helped them bounce into the tournament because they just saw it as an absolute bonus to be there. And it's what Wales could have experienced in 84 and with such a good squad. And, you know, they would have all, the Rushes and the Hugheses and the Southalls and the Ratcliffes would have been all, I don't know, mid-20s at the very most. You know, all within that perfect eye of the storm.
Same to you then, Rhys. Which one stings the most for you?
94, I guess. I don't really remember it, as I've said earlier, but I do remember the 94 World Cup. One of my earliest memories was, I would have been 8 years old, staying up late to watch the final and making a little Italian flag. I don't know why I think it was Roberto Baggio's ponytail, I must have thought was cool as an 8 year old. But yeah, I can't help but lament and think what would it have been like to be the sole representatives. What would school have been like as an 8 year old, you know, going to school the next day? Because obviously the time difference, I'm talking about Wales's performance the night before in the World Cup, you know, I'll experience it as a 36 year old. But yeah, I can only imagine what it would have been like as an 8 year old.
Well, we look forward to reliving your most painful qualifying memory in the next episode. Then,
no way.
That'll be something nice. But that'll do us for now. Two decades covered in this one, various types of frustration for Wales. And next time, as we say, we're moving into the 21st century. There may be a bit more joy coming along to go with the extra pain that Rhys will get into. But thank you both for tonight. Cheers, Rhys.
Thank you.
Stephen, thanks again.
Oh, it's been a joy as always.
Do join us all again for the final part of the series coming your way soon. But for now, thank you very much for listening and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.